This is Tribeca Talks, our favorite conversations recorded live at the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm Leah Sarbib. Jodie Foster began her career at the age of 3. Now she's a film and TV director and one of the most acclaimed actresses of her generation. She's known for Taxi Driver and her Academy Award-winning performances in The Accused and The Silence of the Lambs. She made her directorial debut in 1991 with Little Man Tate. Since then, she's directed films including Home for the Holidays and Money Monster, and episodes of Orange is the New Black, House of Cards, Black Mirror, and more. She sat down with Tony Award-winning theater and film director Julie Taymor at her 2016 Tribeca Film Festival. Julie Taymor's work ranges from The Lion King on Broadway to Across the Universe to Academy Award-winning Frida.
Wow.
Hello, good afternoon.
Yes.
So this is the first time I'm getting to do this, which is to ask the questions. I want to start with things that aren't right to the film. What was your favorite book as a child?
Franny and Zoe, J.D. Salinger.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I think I pretty much, you know, that was the first movie I directed was called Little Man Tate, which might as well have been a ripoff of Salinger. I think that's what I said. Somewhere around 13 or 14, I said, someday I want to direct a Salinger movie.
Can you go back earlier than Franny and Zoe? How old were you at Franny and Zoe?
I think I was probably 13 or 14. Okay. My memories, I read all these funny little history books that you could go to the Doubleday bookstore, and they'd have a whole section for kids that were all about history, and then I would memorize them. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, books on John F. Kennedy or on Amelia Earhart or whatever, and I would memorize them and talk in front of the mirror. That's what I remember.
So what was it in Franny and Zoe that you loved?
I like this idea of a subset families, our families that we create of people that don't fit in other places.
So that's a recurring thing,
yeah,
right?
That's definitely been in a lot of my movies, not necessarily in the last one, but yeah.
Did you not fit in?
Well, I was a child actor, and I'm a kind of a solitary person. I always was a little bit reserved and a little bit solitary, and I felt like I was a lonely person, and I think that's been a wonderful thing. It's really allowed me to play creatively and to come up with ideas in my head that then I try to express so that I can connect with people. I mean, I think that's why we do what we do, to connect with people, and we do it differently. And we make very different films.
Totally.
My films tend to be, I don't know, we'll see where the future takes me, but they tend to be all about reality and, you know, how real can we be? Mm-hmm. Those are the questions that I always ask, you know, is it real, is it real, is it real? And your films are wild and expressive and...
It's my reality.
Yeah, that's right.
I feel it's as real as what's anything real. You know, it's what's in here is real. What's out there is surreal. You know, it's hard to say what reality and naturalism is, isn't it? Because it's all kind of, when you put a camera in front of it, it's not real anymore in a certain kind of way. I know you strive to make it as real, but that's also in the eye of the beholder.
And there's an emotional reality that, why can't it have flights of fancy? You know, why can't your emotions be colored in blue and green and gold? And why can't they take flight? It really is what you trust. I think that's what directors do, is they keep making decisions that they trust over and over again. And I feel like the thing that I always trust is, you know, is it real? Is it real? And I think that the thing that I love about your films is that they inspire me to look at things differently. And they are completely in character. Mm-hmm. In your films, they are completely with character. I think that's what's so extraordinary about them.
Thank you. What were some of the very early films that you saw? What were the ones that made you love the medium or want to be in the medium?
My mom was a big European film fan, and she would pick me up from school. I went to a French school. She did not speak French, not one word. And she wanted me to be able to speak other languages and to travel. She had never traveled. So she put me in the French school. She had a Peugeot, we painted our house terracotta, and we went to see foreign films. And she said, you know, someday we're going to get out of this place. It was, you know, during the Nixon era, and she was not happy with American politics.
She'd love it now.
Yes, she would. But she'd take me to see German films and French films and Italian films, the French New Wave films, I think, was especially interesting to me.
At what age was that?
Oh, from the time I was little. really, from the time I was little.
Can you imagine a little girl loving the French New Wave?
Yeah, and then she would ask me what they said. She'd say, what happened during the film? And it was her way of getting me to speak French and to read the subtitles and to understand movies. She would ask me to keep explaining really stupid things to her, and I would roll my eyes and explain them to her, thinking that she actually wanted the answers, but I think she just wanted me to explain them.
So do you remember the films that you loved?
Oh, yeah. I loved the Louis Malle movies, you know, Murmur of the Heart, La Complicien. I love the Fassbinder movies, all those crazy movies with Hanna Schygulla. Fellini. I love the Fellini films.
Really? Because those are not real.
Those are not real. No, and I certainly love those. Lena Wertmüller, the first female director I had ever known or heard of. I loved every movie that came out of Lena Wertmüller. And that I think there's something about her humor and her sort of wild imagination, and then all of this kind of deathly gallows drama as well. The combination of those three things, really, I really loved.
And when you started to act, how old were you?
I was three.
Yeah. Three?
Yes.
And was this your desire or your mom's?
I don't think so. I mean, my brother was an actor. He went on an interview. I was told, usually I'd stay in the car sometimes, but it was a bad neighborhood. So she took me in, and I don't know what I started. It was for suntan lotion. It was for Coppertone suntan lotion. And they asked my brother to take off his shirt. So I took off my shirt and I showed all my muscles. And I called myself Alexander. They said, what is your name, little girl? And I said, Alexander. And then they hired me to be in that commercial, and that's kind of how it happened.
So was it something that you loved to do when you started doing it? Was it?
I don't know. I really don't know. And I do ask myself that question a lot of times, especially when I'm hating acting. I say, did I ever love this? But I think what I really loved was the family. I really loved, 100 people, these wonderful fathers and mothers and brothers and sisters that taught me things, and, the special little box lunches and being part of the crew and being asked to do a job and being taken seriously and being included. I think that's what I really loved when I was young, and I loved the technical side of it more than anything else. I thought the acting was kind of dumb. Honestly, I thought it was, I couldn't believe somebody was asking me to just say lines that someone else wrote. I thought that
When did that change? That must have changed all the time.
I think when I was 12 and I did Taxi Driver and I met Robert De Niro, he spent a couple days with me doing some improvisations and talking back and forth as if in character. I didn't really understand what he was doing, but I was fascinated.
Did you know what you were playing?
Oh, yes. I lived in, I grew up in Hollywood, so I grew up not far from Hollywood Boulevard, so couldn't have been raunchier. I did know what I was playing, but I approached it in a much more instinctual and uncomplicated way. But something really dropped when Robert De Niro worked with me, and I understood that making films was that I hadn't invested enough in it. It really, the fact that I thought that it wasn't challenging was because I hadn't given enough, and that this could be something, this could be a career that I could give to and that I could really create art from. And it hadn't occurred to me before I was 12.
So, because we don't have enormous amounts of time,
yes.
I'm going to
You see,
jump.
I'm talking fast.
Yes, you are. We went, oh, my God.
We have to say, we were not late.
Yeah, we weren't.
No.
We weren't.
Directors are never late.
We have to let you know, we're directors. We're on time. So, speaking fast, I'm going to jump to the transition. What, why, and when?
To directing, the
yes.
transition to directing.
Yes.
Well, I always wanted to be a director.
Why? Why?
I did a television show when I was six, and it was The Courtship of Eddie's Father with Bill Bixby, and he was directing an episode, and my eyes got wide, and I thought, oh my God, actors are allowed to direct. And I said, that's what I want to do. So that was always where my eye was, but I didn't think, honestly, I didn't think that I would ever be allowed to. So I thought I had to come about it from a different direction, and I really started writing and wanted to write and figured out a way to get to direct when I was 27.
So the writing, was it that you wanted to direct your material? Was it that you had stories to tell?
No, I did have stories to tell, but I don't have a lot of faith in my writing, and I'm very picky. So I feel like I wanted a better writer than myself. So I worked with a lot of writers, and I'm happy that I've done that over the years. And every once in a while, I pitch in and rewrite, but I'm not as good a writer as other people.
But the subject matter, were these ideas that you brought to a writer, or were they stories that you read? What was the kind of, what drew you to material?
Well, the good news is I was an actor, so I got to read a lot of material, and I got to shuffle through and figure out how one creates a narrative and kind of understand that. And I went to a great school, great college. And I mean, I think we all do this litmus test when we're reading material. Does it move you or does it not move you? And when you get excited and you read it from beginning to end, you know that there's something in there. And it isn't always conscious. I think mm-hmm. that, you know, sometimes the most obvious things are conscious, themes that you're trying to explore, things that you thought about. But then there's this other side to it that you don't 100% understand until you're either making the movie or until you're cutting the movie, mm-hmm. where you finally realize, this is why I was drawn to this. These are parts of myself that I need to explore and that I have questions about. And in some ways, this film has allowed me to resolve them.
So the craft of making a film, you learned from being in the film, right?
Yes.
You're
I think so.
Totally self-taught then totally in a way, or absorbing from watching.
Yes. I didn't go to film school, so no. I didn't go that traditional route. And sometimes I find the most interesting filmmakers didn't really go to film school. You were more of an artist in some ways, mm-hmm. the puppets, Indonesia, all of that stuff. You know, you came about it from a different path.
Well, I was a theater director for yeah. a long time before I started doing film. So I'd work with actors, and when you're a theater director, you also have that stage that you have to choreograph on, and the lighting is the camera, so the focus is done through
yes.
the lighting. And you are manipulating, you know, people think, oh, the audience can look anywhere, but not really. You really do have to point the audience to where you want them to see, what they should be focusing on.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. We talked about this briefly, just about the idea of manipulation, which is something I'm fascinated by. The movie that's coming out very soon is a lot about that, Money Monster. And there is a fine line, because we do control the image. We control the image, we control the sound, we make choices all day long about
right.
what people are going to wear and how they're going to say it. And yet we, in a way, it's like a sort of philanthropic manipulation.
Why?
But hopefully we do manipulate the image in order to present reality in a way that we think is true and that we think is honest and we think will touch people in a way that's connective and good.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a fine line to figure out what's good manipulation and what's bad manipulation.
What is bad manipulation?
I think it's all about result. I think you. I see this and in well-meaning ways where maybe studio films, for example, very often will really try to get that result of trying to get the audience to cry or trying to get the audience to laugh or trying to get the audience to pay for those movie theater seats. And I really believe, and I know that I'm naive, but I really believe that if you make an extremely good movie that comes from a true place, mm-hmm. people will come. And if they don't come, then you should try again.
Mm-hmm.
Because making choices for cynical reasons, really for manipulative reasons, for me has always been a mistake and has never ended up in a good place.
So this new film, what drew you to it? Why did you want to do this? Because it is different for you, right?
It is. It's yeah. a mainstream
and
Hollywood
nobody's
movie.
Seen it yet, so we won't talk too much about it because
okay.
we haven't seen it. But go ahead.
It's with George Clooney, Julia Roberts, Jack O'Connell. It's called Money Monster. It's in the financial sector, which is something that's of interest to me. But I think more interesting than that, because I see that as the backdrop, is about these characters, these men in particular, three men in particular, sort of the bad guy, George Clooney and Jack O'Connell, who are all struggling with a spiritual crisis about their own lack of self-worth. These are people who don't feel valuable enough, and so they have to figure out ways to feel valuable. And each one of them go about it in different ways. That sounds really vague. It's actually a, you know, there's guns and bombs and things too.
Right.
But
there's also a message. I did see it, so I have an advantage here. How far did the... with what's going on now, you know, this is very up. It's yeah. exactly what is about this time and the issues that are on television all the time. So
yeah.
how much did that draw you, the political aspect of it?
The political aspect of it, not at all, although I know that's present and we had to honor that in the film. But for me, really, it's a character film. And mm-hmm. the backdrop of technology was really interesting to me. And that's the part of it that I think I worked on it the most, was this time that we live in, this very modern, relevant time where technology is making us closer, And we have this virtual intimacy that sometimes feels closer than real intimacy. So I can look at a TV set close to me and hear somebody in an earpiece, and it's like I'm in their face and in their body. But if they were standing next to me, I wouldn't be able to have that same experience. So technology has brought us closer. We're more communicative. Everything's faster. The connections are faster. And yet there's something that we've lost. And this aspiring to be more like a robot and more like a computer, to be more perfect, has just shown us how incredibly imperfect and flawed we really are.
Tell me about the experience of directing film as opposed to directing TV, because I'm sure people here want to know. What do you feel as a director? What are the advantages and disadvantages for you?
Well, the actual day-in-day of shooting is fast. You know, it's just fast. It's both
television.
It's fast in television. I work really fast in film. So it's not really different. I think the two big differences is that everything is meaningful in a feature. There is no choice of lens, there's no choice of a word, there's no eyelash, there's no edit. That doesn't happen for a reason, or at least in my films. There's a reason for every single thing. And in television, sometimes you don't have that time. It's a bit more circular, and it's more about behavior. Not everything amounts to the final message. It can be sort of bits and pieces. The other big difference is that if you're a director for hire coming in for an episode of television, you really don't have
control.
Much to do in the process. You don't have any control. So hopefully you've allied yourself with a creator that you really can stand behind and that you want to serve, because you're there to serve.
Do you? I mean, because I haven't done television. I'm just about to embark. But if you're not David Fincher creating House of Cards, do you stylistically have to come into a style that's set up?
In that instance, absolutely, on House of Cards. And thank God for David Fincher. It's a beautiful style with extraordinary sets, amazing actors that are already chosen, and fantastic technicians.
But do you work with the DP that's already on the program? So there is. So what are your decisions?
What do you do?
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to originate mine. So believe me.
Well, that's where being an actor really comes in handy, because you're used to serving someone and you're used to coming in and going, "Let me help you. I know you're trying to say this, and these are the different tools that I'm asked to use, but I'm going to help you and use my imagination to bring them to you in a different and more spontaneous way that reflects who I am." And I like that. I think that's a wonderful change. Orange is the New Black, I was on the beginning of that process, so maybe it was I was able to bring on a few actors, and I was able to influence that slightly more.
Mm-hmm. So what are the projects that you want to make? What are your dream projects? Do you have those?
I do. You know, I'm young in my career as a director. I haven't worked as long as you have, because I was busy acting, which was a great film school and is a great film school. But I still have so much to do as a director and so much to learn. My first three films were very, very personal films. And in some ways, they're almost like a trilogy. You know, my first movie was about a young prodigy. The second one was about being 30 and being stuck in between your parents and trying to figure that out. And the Beaver was really about a middle age and depression and all those things. So those films kind of all go together. And this time, you know, here I am making a genre film, something I never thought I wanted to do. They're all experiments, I think, that are hopefully leading towards an evolution of your career that's about you personally. I really will be happy to go back to less of a popcorn movie. It was a wonderful experience. It is a wonderful experience, but I feel like a lot of the stories that I want to tell would be constrained in that format.
So I'm sure we're going to open it up in about a minute and a half to the rest of the company out here. But because we are two women directors, do you have anything that you want to say on that subject matter before we might get asked that?
We were both talking about the woman thing and how we are a little sick of it. sick of the woman thing.
But we don't want to ignore it either.
It's a
critical thing.
But it's real. It's been a very long time that there are very few filmmakers. It's not just today. It's not just this week. I mean, that's always been true. Mm-hmm. Things changed a lot. In Europe, for example, lots of female directors. In television, quite a few female directors in television.
Why do you think it was in television more? Because people didn't take it as seriously?
Yeah, I think the more the financial risk, the less risky the
smaller frame,
right? The less risky the studios can mm-hmm. be. And I think that people still see, for whatever reason, I don't think it's a plot, but I think they still see women as a risk. And I'm not really sure why. Mm-hmm. It is true, you know, what are the differences between men and women directors? I've worked with a lot of men directors. I've worked with a very few women directors.
Who have you worked with? What women have you worked with?
I've only worked with Mary Lambert, a good friend of mine. She also teaches at NYU. She directed Pet Sematary. She directed me in a movie called Siesta.
Elliot great video did director. Pet Sematary.
Oh, yeah, that's right. But it is interesting now, especially directing a larger feature, that there are different styles. Women have a different leadership style. I was never sure about that, but I see that's true now, that maybe it's the culture that I was raised in, maybe it was how I was raised by my mother. Sometimes it's hard for people to understand how to treat me as a leader because they are sometimes waiting for me to punch them in the face, which I'm not going to do, or sometimes they're waiting for me to say, oh, gee, you sound so smart. Why don't I just do it your way? And
that doesn't happen.
I know. So I'm neither one nor the other. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's confusing for people. It's mm-hmm. very confusing to figure out how they're supposed to, you know, do they treat them the way they treat men? And maybe you don't, because we have different leadership style.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have some questions out there.
Can't see you, but we can hear you.
They have three questions in one.
Okay.
Regarding, you know, taxi drivers.
Okay.
So first one is, it's been 40 years. Does it feel like it? Would it be today Uber driver?
Uber driver.
And?
Uber driver, the sequel.
Yeah. And the third one, is it true?
Design.
Is it true that your sister did the ranchy scenes?
yes, taxi driver. It has been 40 years. Does it feel like 40 years? Yes and no. New York has changed a lot in those 40 years. And when you see the film again, you'll see that. You know, yes and no. It's been a long career. I feel very lucky that I was, you know, I started in the 60s. I got to live in the golden age of American cinema in the 70s. So lucky with Scorsese. Then there was the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, and the 2010s. You know, it's been a lot of eras in filmmaking. And the film business has changed dramatically from that time. That was really a time, the beginning of the auteur for the United States. It really was the beginning of an auteur time. And I think our golden age, really our best time. Uber Driver, the sequel, I'm going to ask Columbia if they think that's a good idea. And my sister, the Board of Education didn't want to issue me a work permit to do Taxi Driver. Pretty Baby had just come out, and they were a bit embarrassed by Brooke Shields, by a lot of the criticism that they had gotten about letting Brooke Shields do that film. So they told me I couldn't do Taxi Driver. We petitioned the court, and in order for me to do the film, my sister, who was over 18 at the time, had to come, and anything that would make me uncomfortable or that anything that had a sexual connotation, if they could use a double, she would be my double. I think there's one shot in the movie on her back. It's really on the back of her head. That's about it. My children, what about them? Have they seen it? My older son just saw it the other night. We watched it the other night. It's the first time that he's seen it.
Okay, yes. Back left. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you both for coming out. I'm really, really big fan of the film Contact, and it really helped me through some difficult times in my life. And I just wanted to thank you for your role in it. And I really want to ask about, the film is a lot about, you know, like embracing uncertainty. And I'm curious, for both of you who have put yourself out there and really made some incredible work, how you deal with embracing uncertainty with your works and life in general.
She's embraced uncertainty way more than me.
I don't think it's fun if you don't, you know, if you already know what it's going to be. It's not worth it if it's not a challenge, and if you're not, for yourself and for other people, breaking new ground, telling stories that, I like to put it this way, I like to go to places, bring you to places that you didn't know you wanted to go, which means that I'm not sure you're going to like it, but the trip there has to be thrilling, exciting, challenging, and the most important thing on that journey for me is my collaborators. And it will only work if your team is together and you all want to embrace that experiment. And you all see something there, maybe at the end of the tunnel. But I think risk is the most important thing for an artist, absolutely. And that goes from the producers, from the top to the bottom. Otherwise, what are we doing? We're regurgitating the same old, and we don't grow as a culture. My work is to transform the audience. That's what the job of the director, the shaman, the artist was from the beginning of time. We take life experiences and we show you it from a different perspective. So when we talk about reality, that's not about putting a mirror on society. That's not what it is. Reality can still be putting the mirror from behind the head, can be from here. Cubism is reality. It's just slicing it up differently. So that's kind of the way that I think about it.
Yeah. Thank you. What she said.
Hi, Jody. Hi. I just wanted to say that I'm a big fan of your second film, Home for the Holidays.
Thank you.
Right? Yeah, fantastic. And I just want to know what your memories of it are and how you feel it fits, I guess, into the context of your directorial career.
Home for the Holidays was a real... I love that movie. I know it's not for everybody. I like comedy. It's very hard for me to look at my life in a genuine and real way without injecting a little bit of humor in it. And I will always have some kind of humor in every one of my films because I think that's why I'm pretty well adjusted, because I can look at my failures and look at all the drama and laugh at it. So that film, in some ways, we're taking some of the most painful parts of life that I thought were true and were real in my life and in others, and just turning them around and laughing at them a little bit. It was a great collaboration. Robert Downey Jr. really injected a completely different vibe into that film. And I think his relationship with Holly's character as time went on, after we got through the first 2 weeks, I realized that really was the heart of the movie. And we reshaped the film halfway through to make sure that we supported that.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for being great. Both of you. I had a question about, so some studies have just come out showing fairly definitively that things like Grand Theft Auto are terrible for empathy towards women, for teenage boys. I don't think teenage boys are the kind of key audience for things like Titus, for example, or
Silence
of the Lambs. But I kind of wanted to just hear your view on, when you're dealing with really difficult subject matter, how do you kind of reconcile that with having responsibility and, not kind of influencing the world in a terrible way? Because I think your view would be amazing.
I have some thoughts about games. I'm not sure all of gaming is bad. I have two teenage sons that are involved in gaming, and they couldn't be nicer people. There's always this argument about how art, when it reflects the difficult, somehow will influence our culture in the wrong direction. And I think it's, there's so much artistry that's coming out in games now. Honestly, some of the most interesting bits of art now is in gaming. And I think that along with their guns and all of that comes, BioShock, my son's favorite, is extraordinary. And he claims he does want to have that tattooed on himself at some point in his life. And it is this utopian 20s, 30s universe with crazy 30s music and weird characters that you follow. It's a different way of looking at reality. We do have responsibility as artists, hopefully, to challenge the world to somehow be more connective and more open. And I, for one, really believe that dramas are a great way of doing that. And sometimes dark dramas, bring us light. So I don't think it's as cut and dry an argument as often is made.
But let me ask you, Titus, what did you say about Titus not being for 14-year-old boys? What did you say?
So I guess it was more that a criticism of the question would be, I don't think 14-year-old boys are watching Titus, whereas they are playing Grand Theft Auto, but I guess... I remember reading Titus Andronicus and being like, sorry, they did what to her?
Yeah.
I mean, it's violent, right?
Actually, Titus, if you remember that Shakespeare in Love movie, does anybody remember when the little boy outside the theater goes, he's this little urchin and he's going, ew, Romeo and Juliet, I like Titus. Yay, Titus. And really, Titus is the Pulp Fiction of Shakespeare, which is why I did it. I mean, I was very attracted to it because it horrified me. It was the most violent thing, play, movie, anything that I'd ever been approached to do or had ever seen. And when I did Titus, it was so bloody shocking reading it, let alone doing it, that I think people think that, okay, Shakespeare, they're not going to go to Shakespeare, but you have to remember that Shakespeare in his day was, he still is. I mean, there's over 900 films by Shakespeare. You tell me, does anybody today have 900 films of their work? So the content of that piece is about violence, bloody, revengeful, lust, sexuality, rape, murder, race. It actually touches on every single violent act that mankind has ever perpetrated. The thing that what was important to me was something that I, in like, let me see, I got 30 seconds. No, I have more than that. But what I think was really an interesting lesson as a director, there is a scene, you don't have to have seen the movie, you probably didn't, but maybe a few did. Go see it. Anthony Hopkins, it's related. At any rate, there is an incredibly awful scene where the young woman is going to be stripped and raped by two teenage boys. Now, what Shakespeare does is he doesn't put everything on stage. And what he put on stage, I put on screen. And what he put off stage, pretty much, I followed that. Because a lot that's in your imagination is worse. And directors can set up that horror without showing it. But in this one scene, I learned a big lesson as a director. It was a Steadicam scene, and the Steadicam is moving around Lavinia, and it's really getting you a dizzy feeling as these two boys and Jessica Lange as the mother are taunting this girl as they're picking off pieces of her clothing. You don't see the rape, you see the pre and post. But I had to work with a temp score. You know, your directors out there, you know, often you'll have a temp score before the composer gives you. And I was working with Elliot Goldenthal, but he hadn't, who I know very well, but he hadn't actually done that score yet. And the music editor, we tried that scene with rock music, and it worked like gangbusters. It was pulsing and thrilling, and all of a sudden I went, oh my God, this is exactly the opposite of what should be done. Talking about responsibility, talking about what are you trying to say with your material. Sure, you want to make box office. Sure, it's part of it. We love revenge stories. We love violence and this and that. But we actually put that music on as temp. I played it for the composer, and he went, no. We got into a big argument. This is the last time I put temp on one of Elliot's movies. It's his movie, the composer. And he said, let me do it from Lavinia's point of view. He did a string quartet. It worked so well, and it completely shifted the audience's understanding and emotional involvement in the scene. That is the power that directors have, and I often feel that they don't use that power well or right. You can do the same piece of storytelling, but really think, do you want people to be munching on popcorn while their heads are being sliced off? Do you want that? Or do you want them to feel actually, or shift it? Decide, where at the moment should you shift the perspective? You know, where you, we talk about telling our stories and what we want to say out there. You have to make those decisions. And I think, you know, I think that there's, unfortunately, people get too easy, oh, don't see that kind of movie. Oh, boys are going to watch this kind of movie. It's not true. That's patronizing to the audience. It's really finding ways to do it that entertains but also takes them through these journeys where they can understand what it's like to be in the other person's shoes. That's what we can do. That's what we storytellers can do. Yep. Questions?
Hi there. I just had a quick question for Julie. There has been some adversity and whatnot over time, and we hear bits and pieces in the media with Spider-Man and a couple other things that have come up. In particular, talking about Across the Universe, which is one of my favorite films that you've done. But I know that there was a lot of talk and chatter through the interwebs about the edit and the cut and the studio's involvement and how that ended up coming down. I've read quotes from you that have said that the cut that was put out was the cut that you wanted. But my question to you is, are we ever going to have an opportunity to see some of these other cuts?
No, it is. I'm happy to say, on the one hand, you did see my cut. On the other hand, hardly anybody saw my cut. Meaning that we fought, me and everybody who was on the team, to put out. That doesn't mean I didn't compromise, meaning the right compromises. You've got to, as a filmmaker, always be able to make a certain amount of compromises. But I do feel quite solidly that what you saw was the movie I wanted you to see. And in those back and forths, you get pushed, and sometimes you do things that work equally as well or better. The problem is that you win and you lose. You know, and those battles are the hard ones as a director. I would feel worse if I put out the movie that the studio had thought they wanted to. I don't really think they did. You know, this was a case of, smelling the money, meaning it wasn't that it wasn't working. They thought if we got rid of the black people, the lesbians, the politics, the Vietnam War, Bono's weirdness as the psychedelic. If we got rid of all of those things, we could have High School Musical. And we didn't think so, you know? So we were trying to be true to the movie we set out. I think we were true to the movie. So what you read is right. But those are the unfortunate things that happen then. Does the studio want to go out and put the movie out? Do they believe in it enough? So happily, you can get it on DVD, and it's one of my favorite things, too, that I've ever done. Thank you.
Why are you sick of the women in film conversation?
Well, I think we're all looking forward to a day when we won't have to have it anymore.
That's right.
Honestly. I also feel like, and having been around, I mean, I've been making movies for 50 years, I feel like the issues are way more complicated than the dialogue. Saying why aren't women making the big mainstream franchise? Why are there no women directors in the big mainstream franchises? It's just such an incredibly simple question that there's so many reasons, and some of them are about our psychology. Some of them are about the financial world. Some of them are about the global economy. You know, some of them are about any number of things. But there are so many answers to that question that go back hundreds of years. It would be nice to have a more complex conversation and to be able to look at it more than just a quota or numbers. I always say my favorite female director is Jonathan Demme. You know, he really is my favorite female director that I've ever worked with. I think that he was the one guy who really understood Silence of the Lambs and was able to say, this is a movie about a woman who is our hero. And the film is informed by that. It's why the film is not filled with gratuitous violence. It's why, yes, it is horrifying and difficult to watch in some ways, but mostly because it comes at it from a different perspective. He is on the side. He's on the brave heart of that woman's voice. So I just don't think it's as cut and dry as everybody thinks it is. And I don't think it's a plot. I don't think that there's some kind of big plot to keep women down somehow. I think it's neglect, really. It's a bunch of people that weren't thinking about it, including a lot of female executives that have risen to the top and have not really made a dent in bringing many women into the mainstream world of directing.
Do you know what you're thinking in terms of your next project or projects?
Is that for me or for Julie?
Jody.
Oh, for me?
For you, yes.
This is quick, because I have absolutely no idea. I just finished one entire year with my editor, who's here tonight, Matt Chesay. Hi, Matt! And it was a long, hard year, and I'm really ready to definitely never see my movie again, Money Monster, at least not for another 20 years, but I really need to just go to bed for a while and figure out what I care about and what I love. And I always take that time. I'm not a workaholic. I never have been. I really need time off to figure out who I am. I'm no good if I just go from movie to movie.
Hello, Julie. Hello, Jody.
Hello.
Yes.
Jody, you know that your work is very appreciated in France, and you've just mentioned the French Nouvelle Vague and that you really liked it, Louis Malle. And I wanted to know if you still, if there's any French director you'd like to work with or any French actor. And that I wanted to know if French cinema nowadays has still a big influence in your life or in your way to conceive, can we say this in English, to conceive movies?
Yes. You know, I don't see a lot of French movies anymore. Every time I do, I'm always brought. It's really the language that's a big thing for me because it was, you know, I started speaking French when I was 9, and it's a part of my personality. It's a part of my personality I don't get to exercise very much. And when I go back to France and when I work in France, it's like, I don't know, it's like I'm returning to something that's so familiar. Gosh, directors, actors. We were just talking about Matthias Schoenaerts. He's
Belgian.
He's Belgian. Okay, so he doesn't count. But Rust and Bone, the movie that he was in, that was the first time that I saw him. It's such an extraordinary movie. It's something that I come back to a lot.
It's a
I just
great
saw
director.
It again recently. Yeah. The prison movie by Odjah that I loved. I can't remember the name of. Yeah, I did a very long engagement in France a while ago, and that really is the last French movie that I've made. And I would really love to go back and do a real French film in French again. Just the challenge of it, the challenge of the language thing to me is just magical. I love it.
Last question.
Hello. My question is actually for both of you. I was interested in your process of preparing for your films and how it differs between the genres and the styles.
Well, that's a question for the next hour and a half, right? Go ahead.
Well, gosh, every story requires a new invention. And that's why I don't have a DP that I work with every single movie. Every time I hear a new movie or hear a story, I think of a new way of telling it. And, you know, that's why I was able to make Money Monster as a real genre movie. It really is a general public popcorn film because that's what it should be. But I know that I will return to more personal films, and someday I would love to make a film that was entirely visual and lyrical and that captured you in that way first. I just haven't found that film yet, so I guess it depends on the movie.
Yeah, I think each of my films, whether it's Shakespeare or the musical or Frida, they're very different, so they require different preparation. Something like Frida, you have to immerse yourself into Mexican art, Mexican history, the story of Frida. It's a biopic to a degree, and then it's really the collaborators are the important thing. What kind of DP? Looking for your main person, your main DP. I've worked with Rodrigo Prieto. I've had great DPs. We both have. So that's like your first one that you want once the script is there, is who's going to be the visual eye with you. But I do an enormous amount of research, and I don't mean just research historical or cultural or that. I think we all feed ourselves with images, and that can be going to museums, it can be walking through the city, but often the subway is a great place to be inspired. Just looking at faces, you know, the type of human beings that people this city are amazing for me. So I think like Jody, each film requires a different prep, a different process.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
The Tribeca Film Festival takes place every year in New York City. To learn more about all of our programs, head to TribecaFilm.com.